Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, and welcome to The Upgrade, the podcast from the team at lifehacker.com, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Melissa Kirsch, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Alice Bradley, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And today we're talking about secrets.
We're going to be talking with some of the Lifehacker team about this Reddit thread where people divulge the secrets that, if they were revealed, would ruin their lives.
It's not even the grossest story of that type that I've seen, but at the time, in an innocent age, it was the most disgusting thing anyone had seen.
We're also talking to Seth Stevens Davidowitz, who's got some pretty revealing insights about the disconnect between the way we present ourselves and who we really are that he gleaned by studying Google Trends.
You might think you're going to vote, but you're not going to vote, and the algorithms maybe know you better than you know yourself.
And we're going to get into the psychology of secrets with psychiatrist Eileen Wachter.
There was actually some research that showed that keeping secrets may be bad for our health.
And you should definitely hang out until the end of the episode because our producer, Levi Sharp, ventured out into the wilds of New York City's Union Square to ask people to tell him about the biggest or most shocking secret they've ever kept for someone.
So we had the idea to discuss secrets in this episode because we seem to be living right now in a time of secrets, specifically the healthcare bill, which was revealed to us a couple of days ago, the Senate version of the healthcare bill that was, and up until now, kept secret.
We have no idea what's being proposed. There's a group of guys in a back room somewhere.
The Senate is not a place where you can just cook up something behind closed doors and rush it for a vote on the floor.
The Republicans are writing their health care bill under the cover of darkness because they're ashamed of it. Plain and simple.
Totally secret. There were 13 men in a room working on it. It was shared with a couple lobbyists, perhaps, people that had economic interest in it, but it wasn't shared with the rest of the Senate, never mind the citizens of the United States.
Right. And that just the fact that this has been kept secret for so long has been so shocking to everybody. And it got us thinking about the secrets that we all keep.
There was an article in Quartz by Lila McClellan that I found really interesting, headlined, "Telling Secrets is a Power Move." One of the people she interviewed says, "Imparting secret information is a way of signaling trust. You're saying, I trust you, and because of that, I'm telling you this information, so you should think you're more important than other people, and you should think I'm important because I had this information." Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a way in which we position ourselves in the social hierarchy. Like, I'm keeping a secret. I'm going to tell you a secret in order to, say, buy your loyalty or trust. It's a dicey game using information or secrets as currency.
Mm-hmm. And also saying, like, there are things you can't possibly know that I know about, that I'm keeping from you, is another way of establishing power over other people.
Right. And so in our everyday lives, like, the keeping of secrets seems like something that plagues us, you know? Like, a lot of the situations in which we talk about revealing secrets have to do with the value of being anonymous when you divulge a secret, whether it's through a Google search where you inadvertently divulge your true feelings about something, or it's on a Reddit thread where you feel like you can be totally honest because nobody there knows you. There's something about the shame of keeping a secret or of anybody finding out our secrets that is so troublesome and so terrifying, and it can really immobilize people and ruin their lives.
Yeah. Shame seems to be the common thread that runs through all of this, except when it comes to the Senate healthcare bill.
Which is shameless.
There's no shame.
Yeah. They're keeping secrets in order as a tactical move, as a strategy.
Yeah. As a power move.
Right. I think that we would all do better to start using secrets in that way to help us gain advantage. Exactly.
I've got some secrets.
Yeah.
About, you know, that I'm keeping close to my chest.
I already feel totally intimidated by you and like you're manipulating me. So on May 1st, 2012, a Reddit user named Oh Gosh, Where to Begin posted a now infamous thread in the Ask Reddit subreddit. Ask Reddit, for those non-Redditors among us, is where Reddit users post questions of other Reddit users, in which they asked, what's your secret that could literally ruin your life if it came out? This thread got like 45,000 comments and became famous for a confession so weird and so gross that I refuse to mention it here. But Google around if you don't know what we're talking about and you'll find it.
Yes, you will. One Redditor summed up the contents of the thread as incest, cheating, closet gaze, people contemplating suicide, schizophrenia, weird fetishes, or some combination thereof.
I lost an entire vacation in Mexico reading this. It's very dark. It will suck you in and maybe take up the rest of your life, so be careful. But since we're talking about secrets today, we invited two of the most secretive people we know into the studio to talk with us about that Reddit deepest secret thread and maybe to confess their deepest secrets to us. Welcome to Lifehacker staff writers Patrick Austin and Nick Douglas.
So glad to be here. Thanks.
Hey, what's up?
Okay, so Nick, why do you think this Reddit thread struck such a chord with people?
Because Reddit is a great format for everyone just getting to chime in. And for reading, because of the voting system, you get the good stories. And all the lame stories that are the same will kind of drift down to the bottom. So there's a real staying power. And everyone's trying to entertain as well as they can and climb up to the top of that thread.
So what are some of the secrets that really stayed with you?
I really like the one that you refused to name.
Okay. Speak about it.
The one about a box, right?
Yes, the one about a box.
There is a man who, when he pleasures himself, has been storing the results in a box for years. It looks super gross. It's not even the grossest story of that type that I've seen. But at the time, in an innocent age, it was the most disgusting thing anyone had seen.
We should say that there are photographs.
Yes.
That's the, you know, true to Reddit, people ask for proof, pics, or it didn't happen.
Boxes. Aged, sort of that antiquing you can do to paper by staining it with tea.
Well, there was something that happened in the story that made it even grosser.
I forget this.
Okay, so we're just going to let it out, everybody. He tried to destroy the evidence and he set the box on fire.
No.
Yes. You didn't know this part?
I forgot.
I'm fairly certain. Anyway, so you're struck by the box.
I'm more surprised that someone would share that secret than sharing that they didn't, you know, save someone from suicide or that they were assaulted, that you would share this very specific thing you do, that the answer is not, oh, that's okay, there are many of us. No.
Right.
There are very few of you.
You are the only one.
Yeah. Right.
Do you think that it helped this guy to get it off his chest and to become this, like, you know, meme, essentially?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if there was an element of bragging to it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got this project. You can't tell anyone you know what you've accomplished. It's the story of the guy who skips church, plays golf, and gets a hole in one every time, and it's a punishment because he can't tell anybody. That's what cum box is. That's what it was called.
I know.
I mean,
wow.
What stayed with you, Patrick?
Depositing material in a box is fine and all, but I like the more sophisticated lies. The one I most enjoyed was the man who lives in his house that he sold to someone else, and he lives inside of an 800-square-foot bunker behind the property. Talk about secret, because if the homeowner were to, I don't know, look out the window day or night and see a man crawling out of the ground, there might be something worth explaining.
Yeah.
And that was definitely bragging, too. There was no aspect of, like, I have to unburden myself. He's like, check out what I did.
Cool. Yeah, he's getting away with it, and he doesn't care who knows, except for the owner.
My personal favorite among all the, like, really, really dark, really sad stories was the guy who was sort of sad and ashamed, but also maybe, I don't know if he was bragging, but he was definitely embarrassed, but not too embarrassed by the fact that he was sexually attracted to beds. Did you see this one?
No. What about
he's sexually attracted to beds.
Like the bed itself?
Yeah.
Like the mattress with the mattress.
The mattress. The four-poster, like, oh, no. No, I think it's the mattress itself that it was.
I mean, that kind of, you know, not having read that one, it seems like, you know, your early sexual experiences might be with a mattress. Mm-hmm. And so that might sort of, you know, in the same way that, you know, people confess to incest in this thread and then have, you know, these sort of what what they feel are shameful feelings about, like, being attracted to their sister or something like that. If your early formative sexual experience involves X,
right.
That could...
Cutting a hole in a mattress.
Right.
But in his case, that's what he did.
There was a hole,
which he, in his case, he seemed to feel like it was the mattress itself, which was, it wasn't just the instrument, but in fact, the object of his affection.
I mean,
his affection.
It is soft.
And, but the response was so kind of sweet, you know, people just being like, that's all right, dude. Like, that makes sense.
I think it puts everything in perspective, too, when you post your secrets on a forum where there are thousands of people who can see it. If you post a secret that has to do with something like drug use, and you think the secret will ruin your life, when in fact it will probably, you know, definitely embarrass you. But after that, you can move on with your life. Like, even with these sexual experiences with brothers and sisters, incest and all that stuff, it's apparently more common than people think.
Right.
So...
Well, right. There's this narrow band, right, of things that people confess to for the most part. And that, you know, feeling that you're not alone would, I think, be, you know, extremely comforting for somebody who's harboring a shameful secret.
Some of the drug stories were really interesting to me, that there were multiple people who said, I have gotten over an addiction. I'm done with it. But no one knows that I had it the whole time.
Right.
And that seems like a great use of being able to tell someone anonymously the feeling that, like, yeah, it's a good idea not to share that secret. If you're done with it, I mean, I speak as someone who doesn't know about drug counseling, what, you know, that people need support systems. Obviously, they should find this. And literally, there are many anonymous organizations for talking to other addicts and dealing with that. But knowing that your family was not harmed by what you did and that you have moved past it, it makes sense that a lot of people need somewhere to get that out without ruining something that they kind of have taken care of.
What do you think that says about, like, infidelity?
Whenever I talk to my friends about that, we always have different opinions on that. My wife and I will shout at movies, like, don't confess, just, you fixed it, move on, it's okay. It was bad, but you're not going to fix it now.
Right.
Whereas we know people who would be like, no, it's awful. And obviously... You know, she and I will then be like, but if you ever do it, you better tell me. You better confess. But the person in the movie, no, clearly. It's best if they just move on and pretend everything was fine, because it's fine now.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, depends on, you know, what your partner might want to know, I guess.
Yeah. It's a very shaky morality there.
Yeah. Oh, the morality, it's extremely shaky.
What morality?
The one that haunts me is the person who is a landlord who... put a rag in the water heater of a building that he was the landlord of to keep the debris out, he said. I don't know water heaters. Perhaps an upgrade listener can tell us about debris and water heaters. Anybody know? And he installed this in one of his buildings. There was an accident and all seven of his tenants died and he got away with it. This was terrifying to me. What was also interesting about this is that Redditors who, you know, can solve a crime faster than Sherlock Holmes were immediately like, dude, that's too many details. Don't tell the story like this. We now know too much. They went, they found the story. They found that the case was closed and that the police had blamed it on, you know, a fire in the building or something, some sort, something else. And so he had gotten away with it. But the way that the community sort of rallied around him and said, like, that's really, really horrible. Please don't tell us too much here because, you know, then we become responsible for, you know, alerting the authorities or something like that. That one has really stayed with me. There was also one that had sort of a happy ending where a guy posted in 2012 about being 30 and socially awkward, never having kissed a girl, and he was going to kill himself. He was just wasn't sure when he was going to do it. He was worried about his parents, but he was definitely going to do it. And then over the years, and, you know, in response to that, Redditors reached out to him directly and said, you know, please get help. Here's what you should do. He responded saying, you know, thank you so much for the support. But over the years, he's updated it every year, sometimes more than once a year, and told people, like, what has happened since then. He ends up, you know, having a girlfriend. He ends up losing the girl and having a really hard time getting over it. This sounds like it's stretching the truth. He gets cancer. He gets past the cancer. He gets in a relationship that lasts 3 years. The most recent one said that he's having a baby despite the fact that his partner had some sort of fertility issues. So it feels sort of happily ever after-ish. And it's nice that people did go back in these cases and update their original posts.
Yeah. I think there's also a little bit of an illusion that, like, telling a secret will fix everything. What do you guys think of that?
I would agree with that. I mean, revealing something just sort of puts it out in the open. It doesn't really solve the root problem.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe him confessing that he wanted to kill himself, that he was having a bad time in his life, that didn't solve his problem. What solved his problem was perhaps the outpouring of support from the community, which caused him to, you know, say, I'm going to live one more day, and then another day, and then another day. So I think airing your dirty laundry, so to speak, won't solve the problem, but it's a pretty good first step.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it seems like a lot of people were asking for something. Even if they weren't explicitly asking for help, it was clear that they needed someone to tell them, what do I do next? Often the answer was, here is the hotline, here is an organization to help. Sometimes the answer is, yeah, you may have committed a crime and you've given us enough details that the way we are going to help is help, like, get justice against you. And sometimes it's, here we're just some people to listen, and we'll keep listening after the initial secret. We'll listen to the updates and we'll congratulate you as things get better.
I saw that some people had posted lists of, like, suicide hotlines and places for people to get help, and, you know, posted it again and again, or sort of intermittently throughout the conversation here, which I thought was, you know, helpful and the sort of responsible thing that it's nice to see that a self-policing community is doing.
Yeah, it's one of the best examples of Reddit actually working as a community, which isn't always true. I think it seems like there's a lot of potential for a lot of organizations to reach out and kind of shine a light on how often these things can happen, how many issues that people feel alone in are a lot more prevalent than they think. Obviously, it's a little tricky because you don't want to be taking a lot of these people's stories out of context and compiling them elsewhere, but directing people over might be a good idea. Again, a lot of the people who talked about dealing with drugs, the answer seemed to be, well, there is an anonymous forum for that. It is called Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous. And I think a lot of suicide hotlines and a lot of other organizations like this would do well to look out for these threads and come and participate in them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One more that I just want to mention, and there were a lot of these that were, like, silly and gross. Like, there was a guy who flung his poop into the wall. Did you read that one?
Oh, yeah, and then they moved, right?
Yeah, there was, like, a hole in the wall above the tub. He pooped in the tub. I can't even believe I'm saying this right now. He threw the poop in the hole in the wall, and then his parents, you know, like, plastered over it. So there was poop in the wall of his parents' house. Yeah. And that was just, like, that is really something to keep secret. And that is really, really awful to me and just silly and disgusting.
It's going to be an interesting anthropological artifact a couple hundred years.
We'll puzzle over it. Like, yes. What is this? Right. I feel like if my husband was like, I've got a secret to tell you, and then he told me that, I would love him so much more. I would think it was the funniest.
If he'd done it to your house?
No. But, like, as a child, if you had been like like, I love when people are like, I was 13, I should have known better. You know, that no, 13-year-olds are idiots. They don't know what they're doing. That I could completely see. I could see that happening. I could totally see that. So anyway, I think it's really funny.
Some of those secrets with happy endings have, like, really nefarious beginnings. There was one where a guy reads his friend's diary while babysitting her cat, and now they're married.
Right. God, that one. Yes. Yeah. Oh, that's haunting. That's one that he sort of seems like he wants credit for, don't you think?
I feel like he's looking for a little pat on the back there.
There's one that just made me feel extremely overwhelmed about a guy who had been with a woman who was fat, and he told her he wasn't attracted to her because she was fat. And after they broke up, he realized he had a fetish for watching fat women in porn, and this became, like, a thing for him. Years later, she gets in touch with him. She says, I love you. I want to get back together. Let's meet. They meet.
No.
She's lost all this weight because of what he had said to her. It has become sort of an obsession for her. They get back together. I think they get married. She's constantly self-conscious about her weight, saying, you know, have I eaten too much? Do I look fat? they have sex. You know, he admits that he is still way more into the porn of the larger women than he is into having sex with his wife. Basically, he wounded this woman, told her that she was too fat. She lost all this weight. They got back together. He has a fetish for watching fat women in porn.
This is like an O. Henry story.
Yes, really like is. The gift of the Magi.
Yes.
Totally. Well, you know, it's. I was thinking about this, that like a lot of good literature comes from secrets. And like typically it's a secret that you murdered somebody. Or, but, you know, like Crime and Punishment or Raskolnikov kills the pawnbroker. And, you know, he has all sorts of different motives for doing that. But, it haunts him. He's tormented forever. Or like Macbeth. We see sort of like the way that secrets, like the metaphor is that like the secret is like going to be this, you know, this rotten part of you that's going to eat you from the inside out, right?
I've definitely had the time that where I've like had this like memory of wronging somebody and I've come to them and said like, I have to tell you, this has been really bothering me. And they're like, that's nothing. Mm-hmm. That didn't even register in my mind. And it's just this huge, huge relief. Have you ever had that kind of experience?
I think so. I can think of situations where I've helped other people with that, you know, where they've told me things where they felt like that, maybe things about their childhood, where they've confessed secrets and, you know, felt very much the import of being able to say, like, that's totally normal. You did nothing wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, every little kid does that or something. And hopefully that unburdened them in some way.
Yeah. So has anyone here ever had the situation where they were actually divulging too much information?
Absolutely. I had.
Tell us.
A blog for a while where I was sharing way too much of my sex life in too much detail. And a friend had to come up to me and say, you know what? You know what's sexy? Shame is sexy. And that stuck with me. At the time, I didn't accept that advice. But over the years, as I scrubbed all record of that blog from the internet, I agreed with him. Shame is sexy.
I think you just issued a challenge to our audience and to Reddit, probably, to find evidence of that blog.
I know.
No, that's a horrible thing to say. I'm
what
sorry.
An amazing
it's like
phrase.
Trump being like, I hope the Russians find Hillary's.
Like you just server. You just doxed him right now. You're like, and your address is
right. That's Nick Douglas.
And
anyway, thank you for sharing that secret that will definitely remain a secret.
Oh, welcome.
The Upgrade is brought to you by NetSuite. If you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. But the problem growing businesses have that keeps them from knowing their numbers is their hodgepodge of business systems. You've got one system for accounting, another for sales, another for inventory, and so on. It's just a big mess, taking up too much time and too many resources, and that hurts the bottom line. And you care about the bottom line because you're a business person who businesses. Introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales instantly, right from your desktop or phone. Whew! That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 Key Strategies to Grow Your Profits, at netsuite.com/theupgrade. That's netsuite.com/theupgrade to download your free guide, 7 Key Strategies to Grow Your Profits, netsuite.com/theupgrade.
So here in the studio, we have Seth Stevens Davidowitz, author of Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the book and how you came to write it.
So the book is called Everybody Lies, and I found this tool called Google Trends, which was Google made available to researchers anonymous and aggregate data on what people search. My initial idea was just not only that the data set is huge, that how many Google searches do people make, far more than the number of people who answer a survey. But people are really, really honest on Google, that people tell things to Google that they don't tell to anyone else, potentially. So if you ask Americans, do you watch porn? About 25% of men and 8% of women say that they watch porn, but there have historically been more Google searches for porn than weather. So it's kind of like, it's just a totally different view of people than you see in any other source. And so the basic idea is, just on all of these ranges of topics, there's so much to learn about people from their Google searches. So the book talks about racism and sexuality and mental health and abortion and child abuse and just about all kinds of topics, and mostly using Google searches.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the big things that you learned in the writing of Everybody Lies?
I learned that racism is a lot higher than I had thought in parts of the country where I wouldn't have expected it to be so high. I learned that I think America currently has a self-induced abortion crisis. I learned that parents treat their sons and daughters differently in the questions they ask and the concerns they have for them. I learned a lot of widespread insecurity around people's bodies and sex.
And when you say we have a self-induced abortion crisis, what does that mean? Like, because we're closing down abortion clinics?
In places where it's hard to get an abortion, there's been a huge rise in searches looking for ways to do it oneself. And there are also, I think, missing pregnancies in this parts of the country, pregnancies that aren't showing up in the official abortion data or the birth rate data.
I was sort of imagining reading the book, like, if aliens got information about humans, they wanted to, like, come down to Earth and blend in, right? Stay with me. And the only information they had from humans was the big data they had gleaned from Google Trends and from all these other sources that you had used. And they tried to, like, replicate a human and came down. Would they resemble how we actually behave every day? Do you know what I mean? Like,
I think if they only had Google searches, they'd maybe think, oh, this is normal. And they'd start, like, walking around black people telling, like, racist jokes and being like, or like, you know, or like being like, talking about their mental health.
Us?
Like, how are you doing today?
Right.
Oh, I'm really depressed. I'm worried I have pancreatic cancer. I'm like, wait, that's, no, you're supposed to say fine.
So the Google search is like a truth serum.
Yeah.
And
yeah. And someone who told the truth all the time would just be weird.
Yeah. But don't people sometimes do Google searches not because it's their thing? Like I feel like sometimes people search in this perverse way to, like, see what the kind of darker side of humanity is all about.
Yeah. Definitely. Not every search is saying that that's what you're interested in or that's what you're feeling. But I think on average,
most of them.
I was kind of surprised. Yeah. In general, I was surprised by the patterns that are revealed in the data. So I would have thought, like, I first just looked at the data and I looked, where are searches with the word God most common?
Mm-hmm.
And they were most common in the Bible Belt,
mm-hmm.
which, okay, makes sense. But it's kind of like, it didn't have to be the case. It could have been that people who search for God are like atheists search, you know, proof that God does not exist. Or they're just curious, like, what are religious people doing? Or
Right. Some
of the searches with the word God are God of War, a video game, which have nothing to do with religion. But those kind of balance out and end up just being a small percent of the searches,
mm-hmm.
and are kind of swamped in the data by legitimately religious people,
mm-hmm.
Looking for religious material. So I think the same is true with racism or do-it-yourself abortions or all these other topics where there are certainly some people who are searching for research purposes or curiosity or for whatever reason. But mm-hmm. these people are a small percentage overall.
You say that people lie in surveys, and in the book you talk about the very recent example of Donald Trump being elected president. Can you talk a little bit about how, when you went back and looked at the data, this possibly could have been predicted?
Well, so first of all, I predicted Trump would win from day one, but I'm not sure if that's because I'm a genius working with amazing data or just because I'm a pessimist, because I'm always predicting horrible things. So I was telling everybody who would listen, like, you have no idea Trump's going to win. In part because, like, I thought the country was much more racist than other people thought it was, based on the analysis I'd been doing with Google searches. And you see that the places where Trump did well in the primary almost perfectly correlate with places that made a lot of racist searches on mm-hmm. Google. And there were a couple other clues. Even in the general election, it was really clear that African-American turnout was going to be down big time, because people lie in surveys when they say, when you ask them, are you going to vote? Like, a huge percentage of Americans say they're going to vote because they don't want to admit to a survey that they have no intention of voting. But you can see in people's Google searches, are they searching where to vote, how to vote, polling places in the weeks before the election? And you can tell from that whether they're going to vote. And it was clear in cities with huge African-American populations, these searches were just way down. Mm. So black turnout was going to be down by a lot, which hurt Clinton and helped Trump a lot.
Why are people lying even when they're anonymous?
It's a good question. It's not totally clear. So first of all, we're in a habit of lying. I talked to some psychologists about it because I didn't totally understand it. So part of it is we're in a habit of lying. You know, your wife or husband comes home, or you say, the person looks terrible. You say, do I look okay in this dress? You look amazing. And it's like, not necessarily true, or, you know, whatever. Your book is great. You're a great teacher. You're this, you're that. We tell a lot of lies in our everyday life, and those behaviors maybe carry on to surveys. There's also that we lie to ourselves. You might think you're going to vote, but you're not going to vote. And the algorithms maybe know you better than you know yourself. So if you haven't looked up information on how to vote within a week of an election, even if you think you're going to vote, the algorithms may know that you're actually not going to vote. And then I think there's also just incentives. So you have no incentive to tell the truth to a survey. So you kind of have this idea, well, is this really anonymous? Like, why do I need to tell some random stranger that I'm gay or something? I live in Mississippi. I don't want to tell a stranger I'm gay. Like, I'll just assume not. Well, what good comes out of this from my perspective by telling a stranger that I'm gay? Mm-hmm. But if you're on a computer and you're attracted to men, you're a man attracted to men, you do have an incentive to search for gay porn because that's going to be erotic to you, right? So, so Google gives you an incentive to look for things that may be socially unacceptable where you live. Whereas a survey never will give you that incentive. Mm-hmm. So it gives you an out to not tell the truth.
Right, because a Google search is a transaction, right? And so if you're not honest, you're not going to get the goods and services that you want.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you search for something like trying to determine, you know, which parts of the country are more racist, I could hear people who live in the South saying, like, well, correlation isn't causation. And what are you also searching for, you know, where people who, you know, wonder the most about the welfare of children live? Or, you know, does that data sort of confirm a liberal bias?
Well, actually, people in the South might be comforted by this because I think the stereotype is that racism is predominantly in the South. And it's not true in the data at all that definitely there are some parts of the South that are highest in racism, places like southern Louisiana and southern Mississippi. But there are also many places in the North that are just as high, whether it's upstate New York or western Pennsylvania or eastern Ohio or industrial Michigan. The real divide in racism these days is not North versus South, it's East versus West, much higher east of the Mississippi River than west of the Mississippi River. Correlation isn't causation, but I think the fact that it predicts so many political voting behaviors, whether it's opposition to Obama or support for Trump in the primary, and there are more and more things it's starting to predict, suggest that it is capturing something real in the data. But as far as positive things about our society, I definitely want to do more on that because I think it is important. And I don't want to just say that everything we learn from Google is that the world's horrible and stuff. So I do want to do more research on the positive. I think some of the other sources are probably better for capturing the positive.
What are some of the other sources that you used?
I use like Facebook data and Wikipedia data and Pornhub data. That's not capturing the positive, but it's capturing the weird, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's talk about the sex searches, because I was very interested in this. I think it seemed to me that there's a real disconnect between what men are worried about and what women are worried about and how we're not sort of communicating those worries with each other. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so one of the things that's actually comforting, sometimes because this data is so honest, you can be comforted by the absence of something. Like, legitimately, other people are not judging you nearly as much as you think they are, in that they're really in their own heads. Mm-hmm. So you kind of, a man and woman come together. I think my analysis of the data is they're both just stuck in their own heads and insecure and worried about how they're coming across and much less judgmental about other people. So yeah, so like one example is the amount of searches that men make about the size of their penises, which is not surprising to me, but was still staggering. Like, men ask more questions about their penis than any other body part. They ask how to make their penis bigger more than they ask how to tune a guitar or make an omelet or change a tire. But for every 170 searches men make about their own penis, women only make one search about a partner's penis. And they're about equally concerned that it's too big and hurts that it's too small.
What about male partners?
So I'd say 170 of their partners because I don't know the gender.
Oh, okay, I see.
The only reason I know that men are making the search about my penis is because if you say my penis, you're probably a man.
Fascinating. Tell me more.
That's my assumption, at least.
And what are women insecure about, according to their
So
Google
a big
searches?
One, which was surprising to me, I had no idea, was vaginal odor. Like, that's huge. Mm. Tends to be 16, 17-year-old girls.
Yeah.
And they're paranoid. Like, I don't think it's extreme to say, based on this data, it sounds nuts, but I'm pretty much confident that there have been teenage girls who have committed suicide over a vaginal odor. Like, it's that extreme, the level of paranoia that you see in this data, because, like, young people are so lost in life, right? You're so confused about what's normal, what isn't normal. So then I'm kind of like, oh, wow, like, this is serious stuff where clearly it's really important that sex ed focuses on this issue a lot, like, and says, okay, this is normal, and, like, you know, I think just in general, the paranoia, particularly among younger people when their bodies are changing, is really important to learn because there may be a disconnect between the things that are talked about in sex ed and the things that young people are paranoid about.
So you say that the number of men who report being gay in surveys or on Facebook is a lot lower than the number of men who one would think were gay from their searches on Google.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that's interesting is that the number one search that starts, is my husband, throughout the United States, is my husband gay? Hmm. Is my husband gay is 10% more common than is my husband cheating, and it's about 10 times more common than is my husband depressed. So on one hand, the fact that these searches are more common in Mississippi and places where it's hard to be gay suggests that there's some, that women are picking up on something because there is a correlation between the places where gay porn is much higher than the openly gay population, where women are making searches for is my husband gay. But it also says that women's priorities may be a little bit off because there are a lot more men who are married to women and secretly depressed than men who are married to women and secretly gay. Hmm. I mean, the number of men who are depressed is very, very high, and a lot of them not without realizing it or without knowing it. So it's kind of like, why aren't you focused more on that aspect of your husband?
And did you determine that people are secretly gay based on the number of people that search for gay porn?
Yeah, exactly. So you don't know exactly the number because you can imagine that if you're in, so there are almost as many gay porn searches in Mississippi as there are in California or New York. There are slightly more in California and New York, I think, because there are legitimately more gay men in California and New York because some gay men who were born in Mississippi moved to California because it's easier to be gay. So there is a slightly higher gay population in these places, but the differences aren't as large as in the surveys. But I think it's hard to go from here's how many gay porn searches are to here's how many men are gay.
Totally, because people watching gay porn aren't necessarily gay.
Aren't necessarily gay. And then also you could imagine that if you're in a place where it's hard to be gay, or you're attracted to men and married to a woman, you may watch more gay porn because you're not having sex with men. So you're kind of like need that outlet more. On the other hand, you could say you would watch less because you're so in the closet that you don't want to acknowledge it to yourself. So you're playing kind of a game. Whereas if you're openly gay, you kind of just are more comfortable with that part of your sexuality and would watch gay porn more easily. So it's not clear what the bias is, but it's definitely not like there's a one-to-one relationship between how much gay porn is searched in a place and how many men are gay. I just do think that when you put together all the different evidence, it's pretty clear that the closet is still a big factor in parts of the United States where it's hard to be gay and parts of the world where it's hard to be gay. You know, that there are these quotes from the former president of Iran that there are no gay men in Iran, and the former mayor of Sochi, Russia, that there are no gay men in Sochi, Russia. And you can definitely see in this data that that's not true at all.
Talk to us about the methodology and about Google Trends. Is it only available to researchers or can anybody?
No, it's available to everybody. Now, I've been using it for so long that I kind of know some tricks. And when you first do it, it's a little hard to make sense of, but it definitely is available to everybody and is still underutilized by businesses or researchers or journalists, academics, anybody. I think it's still underutilized.
How can the average person use Google Trends to sort of find out more about the people in their lives and maybe improve their lives or improve their relationships?
I think you can improve your business potentially because you can understand your customers. You can understand groups of people. Like, you're trying to understand a relationship. I'm not sure that knowing about global trends is necessarily that helpful. I guess the global trend is that you can pretty much be pretty confident that you should be less insecure sexually because of the stuff I talked about, how everybody's insecure and people are less judgmental of other people's bodies than you think. So that would be one area.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not necessarily using Google Trends. That's just like reading my article of using Google Trends.
Can you talk a little bit about the column that you had in the Times recently about other people's great time and the fear of missing out that we all experience?
A lot of people put big data together as this big thing. So social media data is kind of, considered really interesting data. But I think social media data can be worse than surveys because not only do you have no incentive to tell the truth, you have an incentive to look good to your friends. So you might exaggerate how happy you are, exaggerate how good your relationship is, exaggerate how loving your family is, and how intellectual you are. So if you compare Facebook data to real-world data, they frequently don't match up. So the National Enquirer sells more copy than the Atlantic Monthly every year. But the Atlantic Monthly is 45 times more popular on Facebook because people want their friends to think they're really intellectual. They don't want to say that they don't want their friends to think they're reading trashy gossip magazines. And the Bellagio, which is a luxurious hotel in Las Vegas, holds about the same number of people as Circus Circus, which is a cheap hotel in Las Vegas. But the Bellagio gets three times as many check-ins on Facebook because people want their friends to think they're richer than maybe they are or have more luxurious vacations than they do. And the other thing is because I've been studying Google search data for a while, it's interesting to compare the two sources. If you compare how people describe their husbands on social media and on Google. So on social media, when people start a phrase, my husband is, when they're posting my husband is, the top ways they complete that phrase is my husband is the best, my best friend, awesome, amazing, and so cute. On Google, and they're by themselves, they're anonymous, they're trying to get information. When they start a phrase, my husband is, one of the top five ways they complete this is also awesome. So that checks out. But the other four are a jerk, gay, mean, and annoying. So it's an interesting contrast. And I say that the Alcoholics Anonymous has this famous phrase, don't compare your insides to other people's outsides. I think the 21st century big data equivalent would be don't compare your Google searches to other people's Facebook posts.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
In the studio with us today to talk about secrets is Eileen Wachter, assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at New York Presbyterian Hospital. She's also on the adjunct faculty of Columbia University's Center for Psychoanalytic Training and Research.
Hello.
Welcome to the studio.
Thank you so much.
So this might be a basic question, but what are secrets and why do people keep them?
I think a secret is something that you keep hidden. It's kept hidden because of the potential negative consequences. And it differs from privacy, I believe, because privacy usually does not have a negative consequence. It's just a boundary for yourself. And people keep secrets, I think, to prevent the negative consequences of it being revealed. Of course, there are some good secrets, like if you have a surprise party planned. But I think we're talking more about the secrets that have negative potential negative consequences.
Let's talk about child development and secrets. When do kids learn to start keeping secrets? When does that happen in their development?
Now, I'm not a child psychologist, but okay, from what I recall from my training, I believe that it's around age four and between three and five approximately. And it's only when they start recognizing that there's a consequence to telling the truth. So if there's no consequences to telling the truth, there's no reason to lie. And also another piece about why children lie is because they don't want to be in disfavor to their parent. And so they want to stay in their good graces. And usually the lying continues on through elementary school. And soon after that, it starts to abate as they're more in adolescence, unless then they're starting to get into drugs or dating, going out with things that they shouldn't be doing. then the secrets increase. And also, I think it's related to the quality of the relationship that the child has with the parent. And if the child feels unconditional love and feels that, you know, whatever I do is acceptable within realm, or that, you know, if, let's say they do something that's wrong, let's like drawing on the wall, that the parent doesn't freak out about it and just says, okay, well, now we've got to clean it up, or this is what we got to do. And the wall, you know, crayons are for paper, not for wall, that it's a milder reaction. And then the child is less likely to lie. The other thing about lying is that it's a way of separating from a parent. And that's a part of normal development. And so you shouldn't be surprised if your child lies, because it is part of normal development.
How is it that children telling lies helps them separate from us?
It helps them because they're defining their own space and boundaries. And it depends on the quality of the lie. For example, like siblings who keep secrets from their parents. Maybe, you know, I'll keep it innocuous, like staying up late at night and talking under the covers and their parents think they're asleep. So that's a shared privacy, a shared intimacy that the kids keep, and that it bonds the kids separate from the parents. If it's a lie that is potentially of negative consequence, that's a different story, obviously. Yes, it causes separation from the parent, but not in a healthy way. So I'm talking about the lies that kids keep that is healthy, in a sense, from their parents.
How does keeping secrets affect us?
We should take a step back first, though, and think about secrets in a different way, because I think there are some secrets that are good for us to keep. And then there are some secrets that are maybe not so good for us to keep. The secrets that are good for us to keep are often in intimate relationships. With your partner, you have sometimes a secret language, you have private jokes, but you don't share them necessarily with somebody else. And I think that's good in keeping a boundary around the relationship, and it creates further intimacy. And there's a sense of trust that you have with your partner that you're not going to reveal those secrets or those shared intimacies with somebody else. And if you do, that's a breach of the relationship and often causes significant issues. And then the secrets that are not as healthy to keep, I think, are the ones that it may cause shame, create guilt, and that cause some stress to us to be kept. And then you have to weigh out, what's the benefit of keeping the secret? Is it better to reveal the secret or not? And that is on an individual basis. With each secret, you have to make that decision. There was actually some research that showed that keeping secrets may be bad for our health, and that there's a part of our brain called the cingulate cortex, which is one of the logical parts of our brain and focused on learning. So when a secret is told to you in the cingulate cortex, the idea is to spout it out, reveal it. And then there's another part of our brain called the prefrontal cortex, and that is more with planning and understanding negative consequences. And so when you have a secret, the cingulate cortex wants to blurt it out, and the prefrontal orbital cortex wants to keep it hidden because it's afraid of the negative consequences. And when those two clash, they're across purposes, it can create stress in the body. So the downside of keeping a secret is potentially the release of stress hormones like cortisol that can increase blood pressure, increase your risk of having illnesses, infections, GI disturbances, gastrointestinal disturbances, things like that. So there's the downside of keeping a secret from a physiological point of view, from a physical point of view. From a psychological point of view, it's also stressful because you feel like you're excluding somebody. You know, in my practice, often the secrets that are kept are about infidelities. And so people can rationalize it that they're not hurting their partner because they're not sharing the secret, but it's really about protecting themselves. And oftentimes what happens is there's a greater distance than with their partner because they're having this affair. And that causes a disintegration of the relationship, really, as well as it creates like a triangle where it's the secret, you and the other, and then your partner who's on the outskirts. And whether the partner is completely oblivious to it or has a sense of what's going on and then starts questioning and wondering and increases paranoia almost, like, are you really where you said you were going to be? Should I be checking your phone? Things like that. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So secrets can be used to promote intimacy, but also take that away.
Exactly.
Is there ever a time when you would not suggest revealing a secret?
Yes.
What would that be?
Well, I think it's about really weighing the appropriateness of keeping it hidden. Are you potentially going to cause harm to someone by telling the secret? Mm-hmm. And that's separate from causing harm to yourself. You know, if it's primarily going to cause harm to someone, it could be something as innocuous as how does somebody look in their outfit today? And they don't really look that great, but you don't want to tell them, and it's not going to cause any major consequence to say, you know, you look mm-hmm. fine. But then when it's something bigger, there's actually, I prefer not to use examples too much from my practice, sure. obviously for confidentiality, but there was an article that I was reading in preparation for this interview by a family therapist, and she wrote about two instances where secrets were actually really destructive to the family. And one was where a couple was pregnant, and the wife gave birth, and at 3 months of age, the husband was killed in a car crash. She met somebody else and married this man, and they kept it a secret from the child that he was not the true father. And as time went on, they never thought, like, should they tell him? But the boy, as he got older, had a lot of problems at school and with friends, and they couldn't figure out what was going on. And the therapist asked, you know, is there any time of year when his symptoms seem to get worse? And the mother said, well, as a matter of fact, I think in October. And so with delving into what was happening in October, October is when that husband had died, his true mm-hmm. father, his biological father. And the mother would get sad every year around that time, that anniversary. And the boy picked up on the mother's sadness and withdrawnness and started to act out. So the question became, well, should we reveal to him who his true father is? We've been living a lie for 14 years. Mm-hmm. And the therapist counseled that, yes, I think it is appropriate, but with time, and let's work it out. Let's talk about all the pros and cons and how to do this in a thoughtful way so as not to be hurtful to the child. And one of the things that we practice is not to tell secrets of significance at transition times, like at a wedding. You know, this is the time to reveal yeah. at a graduation, for example, because obviously the spotlight is now on the secret and all of the distress that that causes rather than on the joy potentially of that moment where the focus should be.
What percentage of the secrets people keep are really that horrible? You know, like in your practice of the people mm-hmm. that you see, people feel like, you know, I have this deep, dark secret and it would be horrible if anybody ever knew. Is that the case, or is that sort of how we see ourselves or how we see the secrets that we're keeping?
I think it's how we see ourselves, and that more often than not, the secrets, first of all, they're probably often known than, and you think that you've kept it hidden. But and I think also that the secrets are usually a symptom of something else. So let's say going back to an infidelity, oftentimes someone has an affair because they're unhappy in their relationship. And rather than dealing with the unhappiness in the relationship, they take it outside the relationship and have an affair. And it can be constructive once the affair is revealed to then work on what were the real issues in the relationship that need to be repaired and improved upon so that you can go forward. In fact, most people who have affairs do not get divorced if they're married or separate, but they go on to have happy marriages if they work through what the issues were. And so it's not as bad as, you know, they mm-hmm. anticipated it would be, not as devastating.
What if you're in a relationship and your partner wants you to divulge all your secrets, to like reveal all the people that you've slept with or the transgressions of your wild youth or something? Is this a good thing?
No. The person who's asking is often very insecure and is looking for security. And if I know everything about you, then I feel secure. And it's also an issue of control. Because if I know everything about you, then I have some control over the situation. And it's a fantasy because we can't really ever be in control of somebody else. And there's an importance to recognizing that we're separate individuals with our own pasts, and that it's up to the person who wants to reveal what they want to reveal as a shared intimacy, not feeling it's a forced confessional. You know, this is how many people I've slept with, and this is what I've done when I slept with them. You know, that it should really be coming from the person whose, quote-unquote, secrets it is to be able to tell, not that it should be forced out of them.
So walk away. This is a warning sign.
Exactly. It is a warning sign. Absolutely.
Okay. What about the kind of secret that's like a personal trauma that somebody's holding in them? What are the advantages of sharing those kinds of secrets, and is there an advantage?
So in that regard, I think about, like, say, sexual assault or sexual abuse. And that, I think, also requires where the person who has suffered that trauma works on themselves well enough so that they feel that they're revealing it in a safe place and with a purpose in mind, that they feel better, that they're no longer burdened right, mm-hmm. by the secret, because it's a terrible burden to carry such a secret like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that they can then do it in a way where they feel okay about it, because often they feel bad about themselves that it happened to them, although they're completely innocent victims. And to recharacterize it as, I'm a survivor. This happened to me. It was a terrible thing that happened to me, but I can now go forward in my life and feel strong about it.
What about the secrets that we keep from ourselves, sort of like turning a blind eye to what's going on inside us?
What is too painful potentially to be known, we keep hidden. And we can repress it enough to the point that it's unconscious. It may come out in other ways, like Freudian slips.
Mm-hmm.
It may come out in our dreams. It may come out also in the way we choose to conduct ourselves that may be uncharacteristic of who we think we are, but we find ourselves doing things that we wouldn't normally do. Like, for example, going to a party and drinking more than we thought we ever would, and we come home and, you know, have blacked out or whatever. And part of that is because maybe there's something painful that we're not wanting to face and talk about, and we keep it so repressed, and that's how we're using the alcohol, for example, mm-hmm. to keep it repressed mm-hmm. in some ways.
So what do you do if you suspect you might have this kind of tension with yourself, where maybe you're doing things that might be destructive, you have a sense that there's some stuff that you're not dealing with that you may be kind of keeping a secret from yourself?
Let me backtrack, though, and say that I think that there are a few things that are we keep so hidden from ourselves in that regard that we wouldn't have any inkling towards. But if you're seeing a repetitive pattern where you're unhappy with yourself about something, then it's you're keeping something from yourself, whether it's, you know, literally a secret, but something that you're just not really feeling settled with, and having and realizing that I've got to deal with this, that I've got to really look at this and see, am I handling this in the best way that I could, that there may be better ways of managing this. And that often can be starting to talk to someone about it, whether it's a professional or a good friend, saying, you know, I find myself maybe keep dating the wrong guy or taking the wrong job and feeling frustrated. You know, I'll have patients who end up in jobs where they're always battling their boss and losing their job. And what's that about? And, you know, often that's about maybe some issues with authority figures in the past that they haven't really fully resolved, and they're trying to work it out in their present lives, but in a unproductive way.
What are some proactive things that people can do if they're, you know, keeping secrets and having trouble sort of figuring out if they should divulge them?
It actually sounds simplistic, but it's been proven to be helpful, is writing down a list of pros and cons. And writing down, thinking about, what are the reasons I'm keeping this secret? Who am I protecting? What are the risks associated? And something about writing that, having that process of writing it down, is already a relief of some of the burden. It doesn't completely relieve it, but it's a way to start. And it's also a way to start thinking about, is this a secret I should be dealing with now? Is this the right time to be dealing with a secret? Is this the best way to deal with the secret? And there was also something I was going to say before, is how lies are so intimately related to secrets, because we tell lies to keep the secrets. And oftentimes, as we know, building lie upon lie upon lie, it has a pretty weak foundation and it often collapses. It's hard to remember all the lies. And that's often a warning sign, you know, when you're starting getting caught in lies, it's gone too far.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So we're back again with Seth Stevens Davidowitz to discuss the upgrade of the week. Every week, as you know, we talk about that one tiny thing that's making a big difference in our lives. Melissa, what's your upgrade this week?
So I tried smiling less. And so this is something that I would not employ in your own life if you are a person who doesn't sort of compulsively smile in order to make themselves, you know, more likable to people. But I've found that the fact that I'm smiling and I probably come off as somebody who's accepting and easy to talk to sometimes doesn't work in my favor when I'm, say, negotiating a deal or trying to express an unpopular opinion. And so this week I tried smiling less when I was asserting myself, and I think maybe I came off as a little more forbidding. But I found that the results were that I didn't feel like I was going to be taken advantage of as much.
Interesting. So you feel like other people were.
I feel like if you are constantly, or at least in my case, constantly sort of appearing to placate people or to be super accepting or trying to make other people feel comfortable, that sometimes that's interpreted as weakness.
Yeah. So it gave you a little more confidence?
I'd say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I noticed that actually.
Really?
No. But I'm just pretending. Seth, what's your upgrade this week?
I started talking to people every time I enter an elevator. I usually would be silent and just press the buttons, but now I'm starting a conversation. And
what kinds of things are you saying?
Usually I talk about the weather. I'm trying to, like, learn how to be better at small talk.
Uh-huh.
And it is helping. People are very nice in response.
Great. So, yeah, an elevator is a good place to sort of try that out because right. You have a captive audience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What about you, Alice? What's your upgrade this week?
Well, I have been... in the past few weeks, kind of overloading on joy-free information, like podcasts that tell me about politics and how I should be scared of things.
Are you about to say that you're going to go on a tech fast?
No, I'm not. I'm not going on a tech fast. Just going to just traipse through a meadow. No, what I was going to say is I had let some podcasts go that I have really enjoyed and that have made me laugh because they felt somehow too superficial, you know, like fun shouldn't be pursued when you're resisting.
And so what podcast?
So, the podcast that I just picked up again, kind of happily, was Spontanea Nation with Paul F. Tompkins, which is hilarious. And I had known it was hilarious and had enjoyed it and kind of, again, let it go because I had better things to do with my time, whatever that means. And it has really improved my week because it's just so, so funny. Now I get to catch up on old episodes because I'm behind.
Awesome. I'll check it out.
Before we get to the credits, here's our last segment where producer Levi Sharp goes to New York City's Union Square to ask people what sort of secrets they've kept for other people.
I have a friend who likes to sleep in the nude, and this one time she had gone out with her brother, and she had stayed at his apartment, and she had gotten very drunk, and she had slept in the nude in his bed, and he was there, but he was also very drunk, so neither of them knew that she was naked in the bed, totally drunk, until she woke up the next morning.
What happened when they woke up?
Oh, she just got dressed and told nobody but me. Her brother doesn't know what happened, and I don't know if she's told anyone else, but she's never spoke up again.
Somebody got busted.
Busted for what?
For pot. I'm kind of a boring guy.
That's fine. How long ago was it?
Like 20 years ago. You know, back then it was a bigger deal than it is now.
I would probably say somebody who was very close to me who was in the process of transitioning and to come out as transgender.
Oh, okay. That was way back when. I was in elementary school. My friend went to jail, and nobody knew. And then when he came out, he transferred. I went to PS19, but the secret was that he was gay, and nobody knew. So at the time, it was the weirdest secret I had kept.
Well, it was a long time ago, but I once dated a man who, soon after I met him, we went to the racetrack, and he told me that he had waited for 5 years to kill someone. He had been offended by something a guy had done, and he waited 6 years to kill him.
Do you know if they ever got caught for it, or?
No, I told him that it was very upsetting that he had told me that because if something happened and he realized he had been found out, he would immediately suspect me. And so I wasn't comfortable seeing him again. So I don't know what happened to him. I imagine he lived a very happy life.
What are the first things that come to mind when you think of secrets in general?
The government. Unfortunately, it's the government, Donald Trump.
Something embarrassing or something wrong, just because if it wasn't something like that, it wouldn't be a secret in the first place. It would be free to tell anyone and everyone.
Well, I think secrets tend to be viewed very negatively, but almost as if people are lying. You know, if it's a secret, are you not telling the truth to somebody? But I think we all have to have some secrets in life. Otherwise, you know, what's the excitement? Where's the excitement if we don't have our personal things that we keep to ourselves?
Secrets relating to relationships, keeping a feeling from someone or informing someone on a feeling, but you can't tell.
So does it have more of like a negative connotation to you?
Not negative, but I think I prefer honesty over anything else. So for me, it is kind of hard to keep a secret.
That's why you don't get any.
Yeah, right. That's why no one tells me anything.
And that's our show. Come find us on Twitter. You can find me at Melissa Kirsch. You can find Alice at Finslippy. And thank you to all of our guests. Seth Stevens Davidowitz is at Seth S underscore D. Patrick Austin is at Pat Bits. Nick Douglas is at Too Much Nick. And of course, you can find Lifehacker at Lifehacker. The Upgrade is produced by Levi Sharp, who can also be found on Twitter at Levi Sharp with an E. Our executive director of audio is Mandana Mofidi, and Brad Fisher mixed the episode.
We always love to hear from you, so email us at upgrade@lifehacker.com or go old school and leave us a voice message at 347-687-8109. And you can always find us on Panoply, NPR One, and wherever else you get your podcasts.
Do not forget to head over to Apple Podcasts and write us a glowing review. Follow Lifehacker on Facebook at facebook.com/lifehacker, and you can find show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade at lifehacker.com/the show.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.